So good evening, everybody. We'll begin by setting our motivation on this Thanksgiving evening. And so let's just reflect for a minute on really the rarity of being able to meet the Buddha's teachings. If we just think for a minute, all of the living beings just on this earth, all those that walk the earth and are in the ground and in the sky and in the seas, countless beings. And then we think about how many actually meet the Dharma and are able to study and practice. Very, very few, really. And so we can be very thankful for being able to study and practice the Dharma. And we can acknowledge that in our past lives, at some point, we created the merit so that we would be able to meet the Dharma and practice in this life. And then we can think about the kindness of all the teachers from the Buddha on down, who kept the lineage, kept the teachings pure, taught people so that the teachings would continue up until this very day. And so we have really a lot to be thankful for on this Thanksgiving Eve. We can also think about the circumstance that we have conducive circumstances so that we can study and practice and hear the teachings. And there are many people in this world that cannot, that would like to, but can't. They don't have the circumstances. So let's really rejoice that we have the opportunity to share the Dharma tonight. We do this with a very vast motivation. Share the teachings, to learn the teachings, to transform our minds so that we can become fully awakened, so that we then have the ability to benefit all beings in really the most excellent way. So let's have that motivation tonight as we share the Dharma. So Venerable Children is traveling in Asia right now teaching, and so for the next 7 weeks we'll review the chapters that she's already covered on Aryadeva's 400 stanzas on the Middle Way. And so tonight I'll begin with Chapter 1, and I'll first begin with a bit of an overview of the book, as well as how studying this text helps our practice, and then go through some of the stanzas, and we'll see how far we get. I may not be able to go through all of them, but we'll do what we can tonight. And so the 400 verses on the Middle Way is intended as a commentary for those wisdom texts written by Nagarjuna. And this text is not intended to provoke debate, but really to enable all of us who want liberation to understand the lack of inherent existence of things. And we can see in the beginning of the text, the homage is to Manjushri, And that indicates that the text deals with trainings in wisdom. And so we can think of it as primarily a commentary on the fundamental treatise on the Middle Way by Nagarjuna. And many have said down through the ages that all of these books on wisdom are just for refuting others' positions, like debate texts, and that it's not really Buddhist practice. And Lama Tsongkhapa made the point very clearly in his writings that that isn't the purpose of these texts at all. The purpose of these texts is to study them, reflect on them, meditate on these teachings. And the reason that's helpful is because we all hold many wrong views. And the primary one is believing in a self that is permanent, unitary, and independent. And for us to progress on the path, these wrong ways of thinking have to be identified through reflection and then refuted one by one. And through this process of refuting these wrong views we hold, we're familiarizing with the view that accords with reality. And then we can develop the wisdom that knows the lack of a solid, independent, inherent self. So the text explains the paths that depend on conventional truth and ultimate truth by describing the objects of these paths. And it was really written as a supplement to dispel doubts about Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way. Because during Nagarjuna's life, he was continually refuting any inherent existence of anything to help people develop the correct view. And so, of course, in order to develop the correct view, we have to do some preliminaries. We have to learn, study, and generate renunciation. We have to have at least a pretty good understanding of bodhicitta. And so this text also has teachings on these subjects interspersed throughout it. And so the text has 16 chapters, and each chapter contains 25 stanzas, a very terse verses, very succinct verses. And the first 8 chapters talk about conventional truth, and the last 8 talk about ultimate truth. And in general, the conventional or superficial truth about something is its appearance, what it appears to be. And then its deepest or ultimate truth is how it actually exists. So we're talking about overcoming our incorrect views about conventional truth of things, how things actually appear to exist to us. And when we study, reflect, and meditate on the first 8 chapters, we gain the understanding of how to correct our distorted views about conventional truth, and then how to overcome disturbing emotions and attitudes. And the result of this is then building up the merit for understanding emptiness. So like all of the teachings, there's this really precise path and method. So in order to understand emptiness, we have to build up a lot of merit. We build up a lot of merit by getting clear about what conventional truth is. By doing that, we decrease our disturbing emotions and afflictions. And so the first 4 chapters help us to develop aversion to samsara, or cyclic existence. And as Venerable Chodron emphasized when she taught this, if we don't have aversion to samsara, then we don't really have a bodhicitta practice. If we don't really want to get out of samsara ourselves and act like we want to get out of samsara ourselves, then how are we going to want to help get others out of samsara? And if we don't see the disadvantages of rebirth in samsara, then, you know, what is our bodhicitta trying to do? Because bodhicitta wants sentient beings to avoid this uncontrolled rebirth in samsara. And so developing renunciation is incredibly important. And so the first four chapters counteract the four distortions. And these are seeing what is impermanent as permanent, and seeing what is foul or unclean in nature as pure, seeing what is unsatisfactory in nature as happiness, and seeing what lacks a self as having a self. And Aryadeva presents all of this in terms of the human body. And so these four distortions are functioning in our mind at all the time, and they lie at the root of the afflictions that arise in our mind. And then, of course, from these afflictions, we create karma. And from karma, we continue rebirth in cyclic existence, and around we go again. And so this text really presents information so that we can start dismantling these distortions that we carry, that without seeing them, then we can continue to create negative karma. And so the first chapter focuses on refuting permanence. And since the aggregates arise in dependence on causes and conditions, they are impermanent. And so the first chapter starts with gross impermanence, which is death. And then it mentions subtle impermanence. So why does it start with gross impermanence? It's because understanding gross impermanence is the thing that gets us to be consistent in our practice. If we ignore death, thinking death will come later, then we will continue to get caught up in the eight worldly concerns. We have all these misconceptions and wrong views. We think samsara is not so bad. We keep tweaking our life to kind of, you know, find the happiness of just this life. And of course, the appearances of this life are so strong that the concerns of this life become what is so important to us. And if we're really going to practice Dharma, we have to look beyond that. And so talking about the coarse level of impermanence or death then is very important and necessary, is really a first step. And we think about, meditate, and familiarize ourselves with death, not so that we get panicky about it, but we want to generate a very strong, clear wisdom fear, a sense of the danger of dying without having practiced the Dharma. So really, this chapter teaches us how to meditate on death, how to train ourselves so that we're very clear that we will die. And then that informs how we live our life in a very clear way, a very in a way that we choose our actions very very clearly. And by contemplating the points in this chapter, we're able to identify our incorrect understandings, to see how we ignore death. And, you know, intellectually, we can, when we're talking about it, we can say, oh yeah, of course I know I'm dying and will die. But when we look at our day-to-day life, that is not part of our consciousness generally. And so we really ignore this fact. And so with this frame of mind, or this frame then, we'll go through some of the stanzas. And what's helpful, what I found helpful in reviewing this material even was that going through these stanzas that are so pithy, so straight to the point, it shakes us up a little bit. It disturbs our ignoring of death. And so that's really helpful to recognize, because that's what we want to go over and over again, so that we get really familiar and really clear, so that we break down these misconceptions about our existence here. And in reviewing these again, not every stanza did that. Some did, some didn't. So for every one of us, I would imagine some really are going to, you know, kind of shake, and some aren't so much. So it's important to recognize the ones that do, and then those are the ones to meditate on and really work with. And so the first stanza says, if those whose Lord is death himself, ruler of the three worlds, without a master, sleep soundly like true vanquishers, what could be more improper? So what this is saying is that really death comes to everyone, to all the three worlds. And if we are living our life and sleeping like a true vanquisher, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, then we haven't woken up to this fact. We're not clear about our impermanence. And we can see that, you know, everyone who died today, they didn't wake up thinking, yeah, today I'm going to die. Even people that are very sick don't do that. They think they have another day. And so that really shows how much we're in denial. And if we get really clear about our impermanence, this gross impermanence, that we are going to die, then that really gets us to start considering, what is the meaning of our life? What am I doing? Why am I doing it? So it really wakes us up. And of course, if we don't prepare, then when death comes, we freak out. Living on automatic, we die on automatic. And if we prepare for death, then we can have a good death. And so in this text, there are assertions from, like someone else's voice, countering what these stanzas are saying. So the assertion after this first stanza is, the Lord of Death who rules the three worlds does exist, but meanwhile one has life, which wards off death. So while one is alive, there is no need to fear death. And then Aryadeva responds to that, answers that, by then saying the second stanza, which is, those who are born only to die and those whose nature is to be driven appear to be in the act of dying and not in the act of living. And so this is interesting when you think about it. I don't know about you, but I always think that I'm in the process of living. And that is not accurate. I'm in the process of dying. Mm-hmm. And we feel like dying will happen later. Oh, yeah, I know it'll come, but it's later. Later, later, later. But death is caused by birth. Once born, aging starts, and aging leads only to death. So living does not ward off death. The moment something is created, it is in the process of decaying. And no matter what we do, no matter what we do, our lifespan is decreasing. So then the assertion, these days people live to be 100 years old. When 16 years have passed, there are still 84 during which one can first enjoy oneself and then try to ward off death. Since life is long, it is reasonable to place hope in it. Aryadeva answers that with, no, it is most unreasonable. And he says in stanza 3, you see the past as brief, yet to see the future differently, to think both equal or unequal, is clearly like a cry of fear. So to regard one's future lifespan as longer when the time of one's death is uncertain is irrational. We think we have so much time. At the time of death, science will cure what ails us. Or, I don't know, as I've gotten older, you know, I used to think, well, I have this many years to go, this many years to go, this many years to go. You know, we create this scenario of how long we think we're going to live. Not so helpful. Not so helpful. And from the precious garland, Nagarjuna, that famous verse that he wrote, the cause of death are many, the causes of life few, practice the Dharma. And so we cannot escape death. And then the assertion comes, though one cannot be certain that the future will be longer, since death is common to all sentient beings, there is no need for one alone to fear it. And again, Aryadeva answers, this is most unreasonable. And so stanza 4, since death is common to others too, you have no fear of it. Does jealousy cause suffering when only one is harmed? So our mind is saying death happens to everybody, so why fear it? But since death causes suffering by its very nature, therefore its commonness does not prevent suffering. So it is proper to fear the fearful. But again, a wisdom fear, not a freak-out fear. So as we contemplate and listen to this text, we have to really work with our mind not to fall into personal distress or kind of freak-out or just, you know, fear, like, ah! But instead, with a mind of acceptance, and focusing on how am I going to work with the moments that I have in this life, that's kind of the reasonable, balanced way to work with this. So then the next assertion is, death does not occur without sickness and aging. As these can be remedied by medical treatment and taking essential nutrients, death need not be feared. And so stanza 5, Aryadeva writes, sickness can be cured and aging treated. Therefore, you do not fear them. Yet there is no cure for the last ordeal. Thus, obviously, you fear it. And so this is what we think. We think, well, you know, I'll get some disease or something, but there's so many treatments, you know. It'll get caught in time, and there will be, you know, treatment available, and then I'll survive that, and then I'll die later. And just my experience working in nursing for many years, I saw so many people who had illness or a disease that was quite minor, didn't seem so bad at all, and they died. And then other people that had terrible disease, and you think, boy, there's no way they're going to survive, and they survive. So you can't really predict how long of a life we have. And when our time to die comes, there is absolutely nothing, nothing that can stop it. Nothing. And then the next assertion is, though death will come and common beings cannot avert it, one does not fear it because at present one has no certain knowledge of it. And the answer from Aryadeva is, it's not difficult to know death. And then his stanza 6 says, like cattle intended for slaughter, death is common to all. Moreover, when you see others die, why do you not fear the Lord of Death? So it's important to consider the fearfulness of death. Instead of acting like cattle for slaughter who see the butcher kill one, wait to be killed themselves. And so we want to be conscientious in the practice of virtue. So why does he say that? I think he says that because if we don't act with good ethics in this life, and we harm others, it's pretty easy to be born in lower realms then, and, you know, to be born as an animal and not have much possibility of doing much with that life. And then stanza 7, if because the time is uncertain, you think you are eternal, one day the Lord of Death will do you injury. And so again, this is speaking about the uncertainty of the time of death. Because of death's unpredictability, we should be on guard from today. And so we can, you know, have some thoughts here about this. Do we know what to do to steer our mind for a good rebirth? So we need to practice the Dharma and start now. And then two, think about if we don't remember to practice when an affliction in our mind arises, how are we going to practice when death comes? And again, we don't think about this so that we can kind of freak ourselves out. We continue to kind of bring ourselves back into a balanced mind state, have trust in the Buddha's teachings that if we use our time well and study these teachings, then we will be able to have a good death. But we can't do that when we know we're dying. We have to do that now. We have to start now. We can't start on our deathbed. You know, it's that old adage that we die like we live. And so we want to think about, you know, how are we living? What choices are we making? Are we all wrapped up in the eight worldly concerns and in busyness all the time? Are we letting our afflictions run each moment of our life and just reacting to what comes at us all the time? And so if we are, whatever degree that is true for us, then, you know, there are antidotes to that. And the first one is to start getting on the cushion and meditating so that we can start understanding our own mind, so that we can figure out how to, with compassion and with knowledge, direct our mind so we stay balanced, calm, clear, no matter what happens. No matter what happens. And so when we feel ourselves reacting and start getting, you know, afflictions start to rise, to quell that, to bring our energy back down, get ourselves focused again internally, and not let ourselves go there. So I'm going to skip some of these because we're not going to get through all of them unless I do. So let's go to stanza 10. No matter whose life, it does not differ from the moments of mind. Thus, people certainly do not perceive. Thus, it is rare to know the self. So this verse talks about subtle impermanence. Nature of things that arise are changing moment to moment and no different than mind. Both body and mind change moment to moment. But we see ourselves as solid, permanent. We have this conviction in this view because of how much ignorance we have in the mind. And even after hearing this, often the thought will come, well, I have time to meditate on death. I can do it later. And that's because our ignorance is so thick. So we really have to have the courage to really focus on our impermanence, to really step into the middle of that and let ourselves feel shaken by it. And if you think about it, if there's something I don't want to think about at the time of death, like regret, for example, then why do I do it when I'm living? So we really want to make effort to meditate on subtle impermanence also. Nothing is briefer than this life, disintegrating moment by moment. And then the assertion comes, being alive consists of a series of brief moments, but since the continuity is uninterrupted, life is long. Therefore, attachment to it is reasonable. And Aryadeva answers that, no, this is an erroneous idea. And then in stanza 11, you would like to live long but dislike old age. Amazing. Your behavior seems right to people like you. So with a bit of sarcasm. So what he's really saying here is, since you don't want old age, don't be attached to the continuation of life. At any moment, be ready to abandon this life, this ego, this self, these possessions. So we can familiarize with that. You know, if we get scared, like if we're almost in a car wreck or in a car wreck or something, we can use that kind of experience to, you know, let go, to feel like, okay, this is it. You know, it's kind of like rehearsing. It's quite helpful. And then the assertion, though one does not want to age and die when these two happen to one, they are not as much a cause for grief as when they happen to one's child. It is therefore appropriate to grieve at the death of one's child and others. Again, the answer, it is inappropriate. Stanza 12, why do you grieve at death on account of your son and others when the one that laments is a victim? How is that not reprehensible? So in pointing out the impermanence of the body, Aryadeva doesn't limit himself to the discussion of just our own bodies, but extends it to the bodies of our loved ones. And so he talks about understanding the death of loved ones, and he uses particularly the difficult case of our own child dying. And he says it's very important to overcome attachment to loved ones because attachment only causes pain. And also, we often grieve others' death for very self-centered reasons. We don't think and worry about where the person will be reborn. We're grieving what the future was supposed to be. We are grieving what never happened. But we ignore our own pending death. And if we thought about the others when alive, we would have encouraged them to be ethical, kind, compassionate, virtuous. But we think of them after they die, and then we want to know how to benefit them. And then the next assertion, though it is proper to grieve about dying, it is nevertheless reasonable to grieve when the son one has considered one's own goes to the next world without asking. Aryadeva answers, even that is not admissible. In stanza 13, he writes, if unrequested someone has become your son, it is not unreasonable if he leaves without having asked. So it is unreasonable to grieve over the dead when one does not know from where they have come or where they are going. Should one ask permission to die, since they did not ask permission to come into this life? Why ask to go out? All of this is due to karma. And why do we have so much attachment with them when it is so brief? Of course we appreciate them, love them, but why be shocked when they die? This shows our incorrect view, thinking the impermanent as permanent. And then stanza 17, suffering caused by separation is quickly gone from human hearts. See too, attachment's instability, indicated by suffering's end. So if the bonds of attachment did not loosen, the suffering it causes would not stop. But we can see in our own experience that the suffering does stop, which then reflects the instability of attachment. Attachment is not stable, so we can get beyond our attachment. And then the objection to this, though it is inappropriate to grieve in one's heart for a dead child and others, for the sake of convention, one must beat one's breast and so forth. So, stanza 18, knowing it is of no benefit, still you have injured yourself. You make yourself a hypocrite, which is also improper. And so this stanza talks about how we may fear if we feel calm, people will think we don't care for the person. So the question then becomes, can you be transparent in the strength of your practice when somebody that you care for dies and not fall to reacting like those around you? Can you stay strong and steady in your mind, in your heart? And then stanza 20. The objection is, though parting causes suffering, being with one's family causes happiness. Therefore, attachment is reasonable. Arya Devra answers, it is not. And in stanza 20, he says, if meeting is a joy to you, why is parting not also a joy? Do not meeting and parting both seem to go together? And so coming together is intrinsic to its separation. Causes and conditions make things come together and separate. The more pleasure from attachment, the more pain at separation. The more pleasure from attachment, the more pain at separation. So it's really good to look at our pleasure as it arises. So everyone has to part. Parting is the natural conclusion of meeting. Either you will have to depart first or your loved one will have to depart, but the parting is inevitable. Then the objection. The suffering of separation can be discounted, for though an eventual parting is certain, the time spent as friends is long. And Arya Devra answers with, the periods of separation are not short, nor are those of being together long. And then in stanza 21, when the past is beginningless and the future endless, why do you notice being together but not, though long, the separations? So again, this just points out to how our view is a bit distorted and how we are so caught up just in this one life. And then the objection, though separations are long, the suffering of separation vanishes when the mind is distracted by samsara. For example, enjoying the beauty of the seasons. And in stanza 22, Arya Devra writes, time, consisting of instants and so forth, is certainly like an enemy. Therefore, never be attached to that which is your enemy. And so since time, consisting of instants, moments, brief spans, which gradually add up, consumes the moments of our life, and it is certainly like an enemy which robs us of life. And when distracted by samsara, the separation doesn't seem so painful. But since we are going to separate anyway, it's much more wise to practice the Dharma. Why wait for the Lord of Death to separate us? Separate now. And keep the Dharma in our minds continually. And then the objection comes. Though what has been said is reasonable, separating from one's family is hard, and fearing that, one cannot go off to the forest. And here when they mean go off to the forest, it's, you know, dedicating one's life to the Dharma. And Arya Devra answers by writing, full, because you fear separation, you do not leave home. Who that is wise does under punishment what must certainly be done. And so here this verse talks about when we think it's too hard to leave our loved ones, that we can't leave them for Dharma. But of course, you know, if we don't practice the Dharma, death will force separation from all of these things that we're attached to. And then the next objection, though one must certainly leave one's relations, nevertheless, only after bringing up one's son and handling over responsibility for the family to him, can one definitely go off to the forest. And then Aryadeva writes in verse 24, "You may think you must obviously go to the forest once this has been done. Whatever you must do, whatever you do must be left behind. What is the value of having done it?" So the question to ponder with this one is, what is the value of having done that which does not yield even the slightest desired result? So this is the not now mind. This is the life of busyness. You know, I have time later to practice. But again, all these things you want to do before you practice will have to be left behind at the time of death. And the time of death, of course, is very uncertain. You know, everybody dies in the middle of something. And we are going to die in the middle of something. And then the next objection to verse 24 is, though going off to the forest is of greatest importance, fear because of attachment to I and mine makes one unable to go. And then in verse 25, Aryadeva writes, whoever with certainty has the thought, I am going to die, having completely relinquished attachment, why would they fear even the Lord of Death? And so if you make effort to meditate on death and impermanence, you will become free from both I and mind. For it is like this, whoever thinks, it is uncertain when I'll die, but I will die soon, and has certainty about it, then one will abandon busyness, one will abandon distraction. When we contemplate repeatedly on death, other realizations come quite easily. The path to generate insight is blocked until we meditate on gross and subtle impermanence. So that's why we cannot really have such deep concentration and insight yet. And when we aren't so emotionally involved in this life, we don't create so much negative karma. I think that's another one to kind of meditate on a lot. When we aren't so emotionally involved in this life, we don't create so much negative karma. And so again, when we work with this content, we have to go over and over again, gross impermanence, remind ourselves of our death over and over again. But as we do that, then we have to take note of what our reaction to that is, so that we can generate this wisdom fear instead of getting freaked out or getting discouraged. And that takes a lot of practice. That takes a lot of familiarization. Because we realize if we don't practice the Dharma, when we die, it's not going to be a very good death. And the Buddha taught impermanence as a way to inspire us to practice. And you can see, just even in our experience, you know, when we get sick, we get a little clearer about what's important, don't we? We're not so complacent. When we don't think about death, we get involved in all of these petty day-to-day worries and desires, but we're totally spaced out in the big picture. And what is the big picture? It's that we have been getting born and reborn again and again and again under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. And this lifetime is just one tiny little blip on the screen. But through our efforts in past lives, we've had the opportunity to meet the Dharma and learn the path to liberate us. So we don't have to be born again and again and again and experience birth, aging, sickness, and death. So when we realize this life doesn't last very long, but can be used to bring so much goodness for ourselves and others, it really energizes our practice, really gets us thinking about staying and living in the Dharma as much as possible. If we don't think about death, then Dharma becomes just kind of a nice thing to do, kind of when we feel like it. And that attitude does not get us to challenge any of our afflictions. Yeah, it's like what was coined some years ago, Dharma Light, you know, L-I-T-E, you know. Really just trying to make our samsara a little more comfortable. And so when we think about death, then we abandon this idea of making samsara a little comfortable, you know? Because the end result is death. So we want to get out of this totally. We don't want to make just this life a little easier. Because why not? Well, because at the time of death, we're not going to be able to use that experience, number one. Secondly, through our life we have been creating negative karma, and so our death is not going to be so wonderful, nor our next rebirth. So instead, we practice today for what is going to come in the future. And of course, the second benefit of that is that it makes us happy now too. That's the thing we always forget. And so it takes a great deal of familiarity to really get rid of these incorrect views on what is impermanent and what is permanent. So we really need to really reject these views. And one of the ways that we can do that is that when we are experiencing happiness in this life, that we recognize that what it means is that, you know, in that particular moment, we're experiencing something that we like, and we want it to continue, but it's not going to. It's not going to. And so this, you know, continual cycle of, you know, enjoying something and then it's gone, or not liking something and then reacting to that with a lot of affliction. So this up and down, again and again and again, we just keep perpetuating that if we only keep our focus on just this life. And this is the suffering state. And it's not happiness. So if we think that we're going to live forever, we put off doing intensive meditation practice. But we really need to understand the conventional truth about our precious human rebirth that is available only for a very, very brief short time. Death will come at any moment. And we need to take advantage of this life now. And so then Aryadeva has a summarizing stanza of this chapter. He says, that which cuts craving for reward and honor, the best spur to practice with effort in seclusion, the excellent secret of all the scriptures, is initially to remember death. And so this is one of those practices where it's uncomfortable, and at least for me, my mind doesn't want to really go there, and I feel kind of the internal shake, and I keep making myself go over it again and again and again. Not only with myself, but with everything that I see, especially when I notice attachment arising, like with the cats. You know, I have a lot of attachment to animals. And when I see the animal, I, in my mind, quickly bring them through their lifespan to their time of death. And that helps me to decrease my attachment, keep my mind in reality, because this is the reality. This is what is. So then at the time of the death of that particular cat, I am not going to be so shocked. I am going to have some energy to help that animal instead of trying to manage my freak-out mind. Okay, we've used our time. All right. So may we realize gross impermanence very quickly, for the benefit of ourselves and all others. So let's do our dedication.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and dwell. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West,